Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Students around the world are asking questions about God, the truth, and the meaning of their lives. Your gift will put top-notch Catholic intellectuals in front of students who are seeking. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students to transform a student's life today. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students.
I begin with these two sets of propositions. The first set I call some moral rules. Some of them are familiar to us. Love your neighbor as yourself. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Do not intentionally kill the innocent. Do not take what is not yours without permission. Parents ought to care for their infant children. Shun ignorance and try to live at peace with your neighbors. One ought not to rape anyone. And there's a second set here, some immoral rules. Your guilt or innocence in a criminal trial depends entirely on your race and not on a judge or jury's deliberation on legitimately obtained evidence. Anyone may be convicted of a crime based on the results of a coin toss. The maximum punishment for first-degree murder is an all-expense-paid vacation to Las Vegas. Government contracts are to be distributed based on family connections and bribes, and not on the quality of the bids. It's actually a law in New Jersey. You know, I made that up. And finally, original parenthood is to be decided by a special board of experts appointed by the governor and not on whether one sires or begets the child. Now, if you believe that these moral rules or these immoral rules, and perhaps others not mentioned, come up with scores of other examples, ought to be obeyed or disobeyed by everyone, regardless of time, place, circumstance, or culture, then you are a moral objectivist. Now, what I mean by moral objectivist, the term objectivist has a variety of different meanings. I think the followers of Ayn Rand call themselves objectivists. That's not what I mean. Not even close. It's simply the view that morality is something that is true apart from what you may think about it. Now, it's not to say there isn't a subjective element. Right? I mean, think of, for example, of mathematics. You need minds in order to have mathematics, but that doesn't mean it's subjective, right? So in a sense, morality, at least if you're an objectivist, you believe that morality is, in a sense, more like the rules, more like mathematics than the rules of etiquette. On the other hand, if you believe that morality depends exclusively on one's time, place, or culture, that there is no universal objective morality that transcends society and circumstance, then you are a moral relativist. You do not deny that there are moral rules, but what you believe is that these rules are nothing more than your own society's ethical code, which may be different, but no better or worse than another society's ethical code. In that case, you believe that morality is more like the rules of etiquette than it is like mathematics. So why talk about relativism in a lecture or at an event sponsored by the Thomistic Institute, which is an academic society created by the Dominican House of Studies, about 11 years ago or so. And I'm honored to be invited to be a speaker as part of TI. But the Dominicans are Catholics, so it's a Catholic organization. So why is it that it is an important subject for something like the Thomistic Institute? Well, it's because the Catholic Church teaches that morality is objective, that a person who believes in moral relativism is mistaken, and that believing in relativism could be an impediment for somebody's movement towards faith. And if one can remove that impediment, that doesn't mean they're going to come to faith. There are many. By the way, in my profession, philosophy, the vast majority of philosophers who write in the areas of ethics are not relativists. Relativism is a distinctly minority view in philosophy. Now, I can't speak for other disciplines. My understanding is if you go to anthropology or perhaps economics or English literature, you may have different views. But in my profession, philosophy, regardless of where the philosophers stand on political questions or even specific moral questions, there is almost nearly a universal rejection of moral relativism. And the arguments I'm going to be going over this evening, at least in terms of the critiques of relativism, are pretty standard among philosophers who don't even share my faith. But getting back to the issue of faith, because the church teaches that morality is objective and someone may be a relativist, removing the impediment of relativism at least would make it easier for somebody at least to understand why, for example, the church teaches something like the natural law, which is something that I'll talk about at the end of the lecture. So given that, why are some people more relative? So in my experience, there's two reasons why, or arguments that I've heard of why people are relativists. And these arguments I often hear from my own students. I've been teaching now for 34 years. Is that long? 34 years? I've actually had my first child of one of my students take my class. That's weird. Because I don't feel as if I've gotten any older. So over the years, there's kind of standard arguments. Some of them are defended by fairly sophisticated people. Some of them are found, at least today, on social media, in residence at a university, people at 3 a.m. arguing about moral questions. So there are generally two different types of arguments that I often hear. And one argument pretty much says something like this: there's just too much diversity on moral issues, both in and across culture. So it's based on this kind of empirical observation. And then the second is more of a kind of social peace argument. And it's an appeal to the fact that it's intolerant to believe that one's moral view is universally true and others wrong. So we'll call the first argument the argument from disagreement, and the second argument the argument from tolerance. So let's first talk about, we'll talk first about the argument from disagreement and then the argument from tolerance. So the argument from disagreement. There's disagreement on moral issues everywhere. In the United States alone, there are an array of questions over which sincere citizens hold contrary views. We can almost recite them by memory. Abortion, marriage, race relations, physician-assisted suicide, religious liberty, animal rights, right? There's just scores of issues, right? But those are pretty much the central ones. People disagree about questions like that, and sometimes very strongly on those issues. Internationally, it's no different. While some cultures practice polygamy and prohibit the killing and eating of cattle, to cite but two examples, other cultures practice monogamy and open up steak joints. But not only is there disagreement geographically, that is, across space, there is disagreement across time. Think of all the civilizations throughout history that thought it was perfectly permissible to enslave fellow human beings, torture heretics, or rape and pillage conquered nations. And there are people that think that's okay today, too, right? Just last month. It's so you can see that there's not only disagreement across space, there's a great disagreement across time. Now, given the wide diversity of moral opinions and practices across space and time, it's easy to see why someone would be a moral relativist. It should not surprise us then that the two most frequently read academic defenses of moral relativism, one is by Ruth Benedict, the late anthropologist, and the other William Graham Sumner, another late anthropologist. That's they're dead. They're just not tardy. And I say they both appeal to this diversity in making their cases. In fact, I don't know if any of you have taken, I know some of you have because I've met with some of you earlier, you've taken philosophy classes in ethics. And the typical anthology in ethics, even if it just deals with applied issues, there'll be a section at the beginning usually about relativism and moral theory. And the relativist, the section on relativism will usually have an excerpt from a piece written by Ruth Benedict or William Graham Sumner. They're sort of the stock essays that at least undergraduates first encounter when they encounter relativism. So they essentially argue that because there is wide disagreement on moral beliefs and practices, there is no universal objective morality, and that relativism is true. So the argument basically is an appeal to moral diversity, and the conclusion is, therefore, there is no objective universal morality. Now, I think that the argument from disagreement seems impressive at first, since it appears to be based on an undeniable fact. Moral disagreement. I think it's remarkably weak once we critically examine it. So I want to go over four different problems with the argument from moral disagreement. First, as a matter of simple logic, the fact of disagreement does not entail moral relativism. Just as the fact of disagreement over the shape of the earth does not entail that the earth has no shape. The mere fact of disagreement, so think about it this way. Think of the premise is there is moral disagreement across space and time, therefore there is no objective morality. Now you'd need another premise to make that a valid argument, right? Something like whenever there is disagreement on issue X, there is no right answer or something like that. But that's going to be the second, that's kind of getting a little ahead to the second objection. But supposing you didn't have that missing premise, right? The mere fact of disagreement wouldn't be enough to prove that there is no one true morality or no objective morality. Perhaps not only can we think of examples outside of ethics, like, you know, the fact that we may disagree about the shape of the earth, it wouldn't follow the earth, didn't have a shape. We can probably, could say something like this. You could say, well, perhaps some cultures and individuals have gotten morality wrong, which is something we all down deep, I think, already believe. We may not admit it, but I think down deep we believe it. Who, for example, would say that what the Nazis did to the Jews is morally permissible because their culture said it was right, or that racial segregation as once practiced in the southern United States was not immoral because society at the time believed it was. So you think of examples of all sorts of other events, activities, in which you think, well, it seems as though the mere fact of disagreement in and of itself doesn't seem to be enough. Right, because we can think of cases where it would not be unreasonable to say they got it wrong. second problem. So the first problem is kind of just a logical problem. Just from the empirical fact of disagreement, it's just not enough to prove that relativism is correct. The second problem, and this is I alluded to it already, there's a subtlety here about this problem. In this one, in order for the argument for disagreement to work, as I mentioned a few moments ago, the moral relativist must assume a certain proposition. And that is, whenever there is disagreement on any issue, there is no universal objective truth on it. So you could put in there, the issue could be the correct moral position on X. So the moral relativist must assume this proposition. Whenever there's disagreement on any issue, for example, the correct moral position on X, there's no universal objective truth in the matter. Now, however, suppose we say in response, I disagree with that proposition. I disagree with the proposition that whenever there's disagreement on any issue, there is no universal objective truth on the matter. But this means that we can reject the proposition on its own grounds. It's called a self-refuting statement. It's like if I walked in here and I said, don't believe a word I say. Or I have a brother who's an only child. I have a brother who's an only guy. It's a joke. My youngest brother, we always thought was my mom's favorite. And my mom passed away 4 years ago, but at a Christmas party at my brother's house, I asked my mom, I said, how did you, I said, my youngest brother's name Patrick, I said, how did you handle the C-section when you had Patrick? Because I didn't have a C-section for Patrick. I said, well, how'd you get the halo out? She laughed very hard at that. So this second objection is essentially saying that the argument of disagreement relies on this hidden premise that whenever there's disagreement over a particular issue, therefore there is no right answer, we can just simply say, well, I disagree with that proposition, right? And of course, if disagreement over something means that you have a good reason to reject it, then we can reject that proposition on its own grounds. Again, I haven't proven, by the way, moral objectivism. All I've done so far is to simply raise questions about relativism. So that's the second objection to the first argument, the argument of disagreement. Third objection, disagreement is overrated. Disagreement is overrated. Spent a lot of time talking about disagreement. Here I'm going to actually raise questions about the meaning of the kinds of disagreements that we have on moral issues. So I'm going to pick as an example the issue of abortion. Now, it's true that pro-lifers and pro-choicers disagree on its morality, but they don't disagree on the moral principle that it is wrong to intentionally kill innocent persons. What they disagree on is what counts as a person or how we should understand the meaning of innocence. So defenders of abortion rights typically argue either that the fetus, though genetically a human being, is not morally a person during most, if not all, of its gestation, or that the fetus, though morally a person, is not technically innocent if it is trespassing on the mother's body without her explicit consent. So there are two different types of arguments that one finds in the literature on abortion. You find one set of arguments that deal with what are sometimes called decisive moment theory. That is, those that accept this way of looking at the abortion debate concede that the entire debate rests on whether the embryo, the fetus, and in some cases, the newborn child, does in fact have moral status. And the philosophers who argue that it doesn't have moral status will argue that although the fetus is a human being, because it lacks certain characteristics, it has no moral status and therefore is not a person. And so what's a person? Well, the philosophers who hold this view disagree. Some will argue that what gives you moral status is your ability or your present capacity to have a life plan and to appreciate your own interest. Others will say when you reach a point in your development in which organized cortical brain activity arises. Others will argue when brain waves arise, which is roughly 7 weeks after conception. But the point is that the decisive moment theorists, the reason why they make the argument is because they agree with people that oppose abortion. They agree that it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent person. What they argue is that it's not a person, right? So there's an agreement on the moral principle. And then you find other arguments, usually are called bodily rights arguments. And these philosophers who defend there's really two major ones that defend it. Judith Jarvis Thompson published a piece in 1971, quite famous, called "Why in Defense of Abortion." And then her most sophisticated defender is a philosopher at Colorado, University of Colorado, David Boonin, who's actually a friend of mine. And David and Thompson argue that even if the fetus is a person, nobody has a right to use another's body without their explicit consent. And Thompson is well known for using all these analogies or illustrations in order to show why this intuition is correct. And the most famous one is you're hooked up to an unconscious violinist. I don't know why violinist. Apparently she liked it's a violinist, don't fret. So you're hooked up and the violinist needs your blood type you have the right blood type for whatever use of your kidneys that the violinist is going to, violinist needs. You got some kind of contraption hooking you up to the violinist, and the doctor comes in and says, I know you didn't agree to this, but our experts canvassed all the medical records throughout the world, and you're the only one that has the right blood type to keep this violinist alive, but don't worry, it's only 9 months. And then Thompson says famously in her article, you would consider this outrageous, right? The point of the analogy is to try to get you to see that even though the violinist is a person, that doesn't matter. The violinist does still have a right to use your body, even if unplugging from the violinist kills the violinist. Now, I think I don't agree with the argument. I think it's flawed in many ways. But here's the point of why I'm bringing it up in terms of our discussion of relativism, that it's obvious that when Thompson makes the argument, she's appealing to moral intuitions that she thinks that most people, if not everybody, shares in one degree or another. Right? I have a lot of students who will say it's wrong to be hooked. It would be okay for you to remove yourself from the violinist, but it would not be okay for a woman to procure an abortion. And the burden on them is to show that. What's the difference between the cases? And the reason why that argument, Thompson's argument, is powerful, even though I think it's flawed, is that she appeals to moral intuitions about autonomy and bodily integrity that even people who disagree with her on abortion would generally accept. So getting back to this third objection, the disagreement is overrated. So, although I think that both the personhood arguments and the bodily right arguments are flawed and mistaken, we should recognize that each is employed by its advocates because they already agree with opponents of abortion that it is morally wrong to intentionally kill innocents. So this kind of reasoning can be applied to other issues as well. If you think about the debates over marriage, physician-assisted suicide, critical race theory, and others, the differing factions appeal to the exact same moral goods and principles to justify their positions. Fairness, justice, relief of suffering, love, and protection of the vulnerable. Where they disagree is over the proper application of those goods and principles and the right way to answer questions about the nature of the reality to which they're being applied. So think, for example, of what is marriage. It probably unlocks that issue better than appealing to the principles. In other words, there's a deeper metaphysical question that's really doing the work. Or issues about critical race theory. What is systemic racism? Is it something that should be eradicated? How do we detect it? All these sorts of sort of empirical questions, right? But nobody, let's say, says we should be in favor of treating people unfairly, right? The disagreement is going to be how best should society enforce its rules about fairness, right? And then that's where but you're going to get deep disagreements about how that exactly that's done and how better to understand it. But this shows, though, that there's disagreement. But the disagreement is not on the level of moral principle. And this is why the Catholic Church teaches in its catechism that even though objective morality is known by all, it is, quote, not perceived by everyone clearly and immediately. In the present situation, sinful man needs grace and revelation, so moral and religious truths may be known by everyone with facility, with firm certainty, and with no admixture of error, unquote. And so even though the church itself defends the idea that people have a kind of natural awareness of a moral law, they also have to account for the fact of disagreement. This is something that I think is the great virtue of natural law theory, is that it can give an account of disagreement. This is something that is often forgotten, even by some defenders of Thomas Aquinas's view of the natural law. It's in the Summa Theologica, in the section on the treatise of law, he actually has an entire, one of the questions under his discussion of the natural law talks about disagreement, and he brings this up. There's all sorts of reasons why people don't live consistently what the moral law is, or why they aren't really conspicuously aware of it on every occasion. So I have students, for example, who know that plagiarism is wrong. They know it, and guess what? They do it anyways. Why do they do it? Well, because there's a lot of things going on in moral reasoning besides reasoning. We also have emotions and passions. Right? And maybe they just don't like philosophy, which I find to be just shocking. And so, in fact, I had a student whose plagiarism was so bad, not even his sin was original. All right. I waited. I just told that whole thing just to get that joke. So for the fourth objection to the argument of disagreement. The argument of disagreement leads to absurd consequences. If moral relativism is correct, that there is no universal objective morality, then it is not wrong everywhere and always to rape another person, intentionally kill the innocent, torture children for fun, judge Mother Teresa as no better than Hitler, and abandon one's infant offspring to the elements if one finds them inconvenient. So here, this fourth objection is a version of what philosophers will call counterexamples. It's a kind of dumbfounding. It's telling the relativist, look, if in fact you want to maintain this view, you're going to have to accept that these bad consequences arise. And the fourth objection is relying on the fact that your interlocutor is going to say, oh my gosh, I didn't think about that, and maybe back away a little bit from relativism, right? So we, you know, this is something that I think as a kind of, I'm going to say mental exercise, but that's not the right term, a kind of discipline, I think as everyone should employ, not only students, but professors, is not to get bullied by theories, but to rely on what you already know. So if someone gives you, let's say, an argument for relativism, or I'll move it away from morality. Supposing, this is an old example that I've used over the years. Supposing you're married and you're at a marriage encounter. Do you know what a marriage encounter is? My wife made me go to one 30 years ago. It's you spend a weekend with your spouse and other couples, and you listen to lectures from other couples about their marriages and what they've learned over the years, and then you spend some time alone with your spouse, and you write your feelings down about things. And it was unfortunately during football season. No. But imagine you're in a marriage and one of the speakers is at the podium and talks about what it means to be a good spouse. And let's say the person is at the podium and they say, a good spouse washes her husband's socks by hand. Now, do you accept that as a theory, or do you say, you know what, my wife is good, that criterion must be wrong? So one of the things that I think we more often than we think actually make judgments about what we already think we know as a way to judge other views. In other words, there are certain things that we're so certain about, even if we're not conscientiously aware of them, that we reject views out of hand, right? So this affects the way, by the way, how we interpret really strange or odd events too. Like if somebody tells you that a friend had done something that's wicked and you know the person and you just can't imagine them doing it, oftentimes you're less likely to accept, you're more likely to reject that evidence, right? Even if the evidence would be ordinarily good with somebody you didn't know, right? So sometimes it actually makes sense to rely on what you already know, and sometimes it doesn't. But this fourth objection is a kind of appeal to what the relativist should also find appalling as well. It also means that there can be neither moral progress nor moral reformers. So what would be moral progress? Something like the eradication of chattel slavery. Moral reformers, people that have engaged in public activity to get rid of or remove certain types of injustices, right? You think of something like prison reform, civil rights. Throughout history, there have been people like that. And oftentimes facing strong resistance from their society. But if in fact relativism is the case, there really can't be moral reformers or reformation. It can only be change. That's it. And if you think about it, if you're a kind of cultural relativist, if you believe that morality is relative to culture and we're obligated to follow what our culture teaches, that would mean that the reformers are actually wrong until they get enough people to agree with them. And that seems kind of counterintuitive, weird. And the idea of moral progress makes sense, right? We'd like to think that in some ways, societies and cultures can improve just like individuals can, right? You ever look back on, you know, last couple of years, and supposing you have, you know, have bad habits, you have weaknesses, right? So One weakness that I've always had is whenever I've my wife called me out on this. She goes, you know, whenever you meet somebody new, you're always trying to find something in your life to tie it to theirs. And it's a bad habit. And I go, ooh, that's really bad, isn't it? And so I've worked on that, not to do that, right? And because it's narcissistic, right? Or at least it comes across that, right? So those are, so, and you think, well, I'm better at that now, right? You'd like to think that. Right? So the idea of moral progress only makes sense if there's a kind of moral ideal to which, in a sense, we're ordered. Now to the second argument. The argument from tolerance. So some people argue that because it is intolerant to believe that one's moral views are right and others wrong, it follows that moral relativism, the view that there is no one universal objective morality, best establishes tolerance. Now, this was actually the thinking behind the once popular primary and secondary curriculum called values clarification. I don't know if any of you heard of that. When I was a kid, this was a big thing. They would have, it was a way to teach ethics to elementary and high school kids. And it would be these kind of like these stories, like lifeboat scenarios. Like there's 11 people on a lifeboat, only 8 can survive. And you have to figure out which 3 to throw off because not all 11 can survive. Like if all 11 stay, then, you know, they're all going to die. And it's a horrible way to teach ethics because it gives students the impression that every single ethical issue is a dilemma. Right. I mean, there are dilemmas. There are difficult moral issues, but not all of them are difficult. Right. Like taking money out of your mom's purse is not a difficult. That's wrong. Right. You know. Killing Fred because he looked at you funny. It's not a moral dilemma. It's wrong. But there was a good, in a way, there was a noble motive behind the values curriculum. Even though the curriculum was really bad philosophically, it was based on the idea that America is a country, we have a wide range of views from different cultural backgrounds, and so it was an attempt for people to better understand each other. And so the argument from tolerance kind of comes from that same good place, but I still think it's a flawed argument. And there's several reasons why I think we should reject it. The first is that the moral relativist seems to be affirming at least one absolute moral principle, namely tolerance. Right? To claim that everyone ought to be tolerant is in fact to affirm a universal objective moral principle. But in that case, the relativist is no longer a relativist. Secondly, why believe that relativism leads to tolerance? I mean, we could easily imagine an intolerant relativist, right? So think about the guy that says something like this. Although I believe all morality is culturally relative, I prefer my culture's morality to all others, and thus, I want my nation to ban all immigrants from other cultures. In other words, somebody could, or something like this. I don't think there's any objective morality, but I just prefer my culture over others, and that's why we can invade you. Right? There's nothing about relativism necessarily would lead to tolerance. You could easily imagine somebody being a relativist and using that as the reason to be intolerant. Right? There's no connection whatsoever. And then finally, the practice of tolerance seems valuable because it establishes certain goods, such as living at peace with others and better understanding those with whom one disagrees. But these goods seem to be functioning as if they were part of some universal objective morality, which is inconsistent with moral relativism. So if you think about it, what would be the point of being tolerant with other people or other of other people? Well, I want to get along with people. Well, that means that living at peace with others is a good. Maybe I can learn something from them. Oh, that means that it's good to learn things, right? It's good to become wiser. Or maybe they can learn something from you. Or maybe you don't change your mind, but you develop a better understanding of your own views. All those are goods, right? They all lead to human flourishing in one way or another. And so if anything, tolerance seems to be more at home in a worldview that accepts moral objectivism. And sometimes people use tolerance in a kind of unfair way. I had a guy a couple of years ago, I published this book with Cambridge University Press on the abortion controversy. And it was before podcasts and before social media. I mean, there was an internet, but it wasn't. So I actually had all these radio interviews, and I was interviewed, Iowa State University radio station. What are they? The Cyclones. That's a weird mascot, isn't it? Like, it's like a natural disaster. It's like the plague, right? No school would be called the plague, would it? But they're cyclones. So it's weird. Okay, so I'm on the radio show at Iowa State, and this guy calls up. It's a call-in show, and he says, Beckwith, the problem with you is that you think you're right and other people are wrong. You're intolerant. And I said, well, wait a second. Do you think I'm wrong in thinking that way? He said, yes. And I said, well, you're just like me then. You think you're right and I'm wrong. We don't actually... Our disagreement is over a substantive question. It isn't that you're the nice guy and I'm not. That's the way he wanted to frame it, right? Like, you know, but yet at the end of the day, our disagreement is over a substantive question, right? And we think each other is wrong, right? And let's have a discussion about it. But to sort of frame it as, well, you think you're right, everyone's, well, of course, everyone, down deep, everyone kind of thinks that way. About their own views, right? That's just human nature, right? You wouldn't believe them if you didn't think they were true. It's the very nature of having certain beliefs. All right, so let me just say a few things. We have only a few minutes left. I want to just say a few things about natural law and where that ties in. So much of what I've argued, in fact, virtually everything I've argued in the Critique of Relativism, it was a kind of backwards way to argue that there's such a thing as a natural law. And in, what do you mean by natural law? Natural law, in a shorthand way, is to say that there are certain moral rules or moral beliefs that can be derived from our knowledge of human nature. That's at its most basic level. It doesn't give you an awful lot of content, to be sure. And that's why the Catholic Church is kind of modest in its use of natural law in terms of a lot of specific questions. But it does explain a lot of why we first off disagree on certain questions and why there seems to be things that we can't not know, to coin a phrase taken from the University of Texas philosopher, Jay Budziszewski. It's the idea of the natural law is presupposed when we speak of human rights and unjust laws. So think, for example, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is actually one of the drafters of it was the Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain, and deeply influenced by Thomistic natural law. And think also of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail. I don't know if any of you, if not all of you, have read it. When I teach contemporary moral problems at Baylor, the first 3 weeks of class, we read, well, we do a couple of other readings, but two of the readings I have my students go over is King's letter and the Platonic dialogue, the Credo. I don't know if you've read that. That's when... Socrates is he's in jail or he's under house arrest, and his friend Credo comes in to talk him out of taking the hemlock. He had been given a death sentence. And the reason why I have my students read both of these is that you have Martin Luther King Jr., who's writing from a Birmingham jail, Socrates, who is arguing with his friend under house arrest, and they are 2,500 years apart. And yet they are within the same moral tradition, which is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary thing to say they're appealing to some of the same kinds of intuitions, although they come to slightly different conclusions. But they both are willing to be punished for what they think is right. King doesn't escape from jail. He takes his punishment. Socrates takes the hemlock, right? So they both, in a sense, do what they think is morally right and yet accept the deliverances of the law. Just sort of interesting. And they both appeal to, again, the same kind of moral intuition. One more thing, and this is a repeating of what I mentioned earlier. The idea of the natural law also accounts for our deep disagreements. And we've already gone over the several examples. But think, for instance, of something outside of some of the examples we've already used. Think about something like truth-telling. There's a general view that if you just cross-culturally, people will say it's wrong to lie. But people are going to disagree on specific cases of when it is permissible to not tell the truth. You know, it's wrong to lie to your professor. Right. But is it wrong to lie to the Nazi that comes to your door while you're hiding Jews in your basement in 1939? You're living in Germany. And but those sorts of exceptions themselves point towards other moral goods, right? Life-saving is more important. And then you're going to have people disagree on whether that's the right way to balance those sorts of goods. But the one thing that you find, though, is that they're in the same conversation. They're appealing to the same exact moral principle. So to conclude, moral relativists, I think, have their hearts in the right place. They rightly recognize differences of moral beliefs and practices between individuals and across cultures, while at the same time wanting to advance the cause of tolerance and understanding. But as we've seen, despite their good motives, the view they hold, moral relativism has many significant flaws. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.